Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santaferadiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Darryl Wilkes. He's writer, producer, and director of the film Hip Hop Hope, which screens on Saturday and Sunday this weekend at Tipton Hall. Sponsored by the Santa Fe Art Institute. It's part of a whole weekend full of events sponsored by the Santa Fe Art Institute, along with the Santa Fe University of Art and Design, and hip-hop anthologist Daniel Banks, the Youth Media Project, students from the Santa Fe School for the Arts. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So, you made this film in the months after 9/11. Now, you were living in New York City several blocks from 9/11 when the towers were hit.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I was living in Tribeca, four blocks north of the North Tower. So my experience of that day was pretty up close and traumatic, you know, because it was an experience that scarred my neighborhood. You know, something that happened very, very, very much in the realm of my everyday life. So it had a big impact on me.
What happened? Were you at home?
Yeah, I was at home that morning, and I was up early getting ready for a job interview, and it was a beautiful September morning, as everyone remembers, and the windows and doors to my apartment were open, and I suddenly heard the crash of the first plane hitting the North Tower, and, you know, none of us could imagine what that could have possibly been. It shook the building. And I ran downstairs to the street and looked up at the tower and saw the gaping hole, smoking hole. And at first, everyone was kind of minimizing what happened. Everyone was saying that a small plane crashed or whatever. But obviously, something much bigger had happened. So I ran upstairs and I got my video camera because I'm a documentary filmmaker. And I started, you know, shooting the fire, and then I remember at one point I suddenly put my camera down because I was seeing what I had initially thought was debris falling from the building, and I suddenly realized it was people jumping, and it just just didn't seem right to continue shooting. So as I was standing there with my neighbors, we all witnessed the second plane crash into the South Tower, and it was at that point that my wife at the time and decided that we needed to get out of there with our dogs, and we fled as the South Tower was collapsing around us, headed uptown.
And where did you go?
My brother-in-law and sister-in-law lived uptown on 96th and 5th Avenue, and you know, I was a bit freaked out, thinking like maybe something was going to be happening in Midtown or whatever, but my wife was insistent that we try to get uptown, so we walked for blocks and blocks and blocks, and eventually found a cab driver who took us all the way uptown. And that's where we stayed for the next few weeks, because we weren't allowed back into our apartment until then. And when we were finally allowed back, we basically had to endure a year of that toxic dust and smoldering aftermath of Ground Zero. And
which they told you was perfectly healthy.
Yeah, well, they claimed it was probably safe, but, you know, we all sort of had an idea they were wrong, but what do you do? It's your home. So we were back there, and it was in October that I decided that I somehow needed to find some way to express myself creatively in order to come to terms with, you know, my sort of grief and angst and emotions over what I had experienced. And that was the beginning, the genesis of this film, Hip Hop Hope.
Now, you were at that point a fan of hip-hop music, or you'd been working on a documentary about hip-hop music?
Yeah, I wasn't a fan of hip-hop music, but I spent the year prior to 9/11 working on another documentary about the underground hip-hop scene in New York City, which actually fell apart in the summer prior to 9/11 because of legal reasons. But during that time, I'd sort of become infatuated with aspects of the underground hip-hop culture in New York City. It's sort of its creative expression, its metaphysical aspects, its, you know, its spiritual elements. And so in October of 2001, a little over a month after 9/11, I picked up my camera again and found a new cast of characters, of disenfranchised street artists, hip-hop artists from the underground hip-hop scene. And I followed them around. And because of the timing, the film became very much about their reactions and their feelings about the events of 9/11 and the impact it had on their lives and their culture.
So these were basically, well, black, white, Latino, pretty much hip-hop folks. And one thing that was interesting is their skepticism, some of them, about the word hope, about the idea of having hopes and dreams.
Right. But at the same time, what was kind of, what was interesting and what evolved was, as they were relating to me the kind of degradation of hip-hop music in regards to, in its inception, when hip-hop culture was conceived in the 70s in the South Bronx, it was a celebration of their culture and their neighborhood. But over the years, in the hip-hop music industry, basically, the values that they originally celebrated degraded into aspects that kind of were misogynistic, materialistic, anyway, qualities that no longer celebrated who they were. And as these hip-hop artists were talking about that, they were making the analogy as to the degradation of American culture and that might have led to some of the events of 9/11.
Which is interesting because from the super ultra right-wing perspective, there were also some people who were saying that the United States got 9/11 in response to the degradation of its culture, but it was from a completely different perspective.
Yeah. What was kind of interesting about this film is, first of all, I made it very quickly, and it premiered 7 months later at the first Tribeca Film Festival in New York, which was created by Robert De Niro as a way to revitalize the neighborhood of Tribeca culturally. And the film went on to compete in many film festivals domestically and internationally, but it never had a commercial release in the U.S. And I think it's because some of the political beliefs expressed in this film were considered anti-American at a time when there was no tolerance or little tolerance for anything like that, you know, for any dissenting point of view. But that very aspect made it attractive to international audiences. And so besides competing in film festivals internationally, it was also broadcast on television in the Netherlands and Spain and New Zealand.
I felt while watching it that these hip-hop artists had a more astute political analysis than a lot of politicians, that they understood not only the realities of oppression, because they were the disenfranchised people, and they talk about how they built the country but didn't really get anything back from it and things like that, but also, I mean, one of them says, yeah, this was a horrible thing, and it was horrible for everybody who died or who lost somebody in 9/11. And at the same time, stuff like this goes on all over the world, and we really don't grieve for other people at all.
Yeah, I think it was a very wise analysis on their part, but it comes from the fact that they lived very close to the streets. I mean, they lived a very similar version in New York City where, you know, poverty was just a part of their lives and crime and oppression and all of those things. So it was more obvious to them than to, I think, the comfortable middle class.
So these artists, who were they? How did you find them? How did you get them to work with you?
It was a very interesting process. It became a word of mouth sort of thing. I would meet one And he would say, you know, invite me to a club or to an event or something, and then I would meet another one, and then they would tell me about someone else. So it had a sort of very organic, you know, chemistry. You know, they're part of an underground hip-hop scene that existed in New York City at that time, but it wasn't organized. You know, it was all very scattered and whatever. They didn't all know each other, but at least one knew the other one. You know, and that's how I found them.
And how did you approach them? You said, I'm making a film about 9/11. Can you respond to it, essentially?
Yeah, that, you know, 9/11 had a huge impact on New York City. I mean, it had a huge impact on the world and the country, but especially New York City. It was something that happened in our town, you know. So people were very open to expressing a point of view about that. And these people are especially looking for a voice, you know, and a platform. And I found them to be very generous of spirit, you know, and very willing to be open. But they had their trepidations as well, you know.
So there's a woman in the film called La Bruja.
Yes.
Latina rapper, artist, and just as smart as they come.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an opportunity to hear how she thinks, see her work, and a bunch of people, same thing. Have you kept in touch with them? Have you followed up?
No, unfortunately, I've lost touch with all of them. You know, I kind of feel bad about that, but it's just the nature of life in New York City and the light. Now I'm no longer even a part of New York. You know, I live in Santa Fe. But after not having seen this film for a while and watching it recently, I'm just so impressed with kind of like the spiritual kind of content of their message and their metaphysical kind of content of what they have to say and the poetry. You know, I mean, that's very much a part of hip-hop music. Hip-hop culture is poetry in a sense. It's street poetry, and these people are incredibly eloquent and articulate.
The hope that 9/11, it's called Hip Hop Hope, and so the theme of hope comes up over and over, and this hope that 9/11 would be a wake-up call.
Mm-hmm.
It's poignant to watch it 10 years later and see that that really did not pan out the way that these folks had hoped for.
Yeah, but what maybe did pan out on a personal level for them is that what I didn't articulate earlier is that, you know, this sort of like degradation of hip-hop from its original beginnings, these people suddenly felt galvanized by the events of 9/11 and decided to infuse their personal expression of hip-hop in a more positive way. They were tired of, you know, supporting the kind of negative images expressed in commercial hip-hop, the misogynism, the materialism, the, you know, all of those things. So on a personal level, you know, they were inspired to make their messages more positive. And whether or not it panned out politically for the world, that's, you know, that's a separate issue.
Right, right. I was amazed to find out that you were not a long-term hip-hop fan, because the film itself is a work of art. The way that it flows, that cutting of the documentary, talking head, somebody walking down the street having a conversation with you, and then cut with the music, the poetry, mm-hmm. the rhythm, the music. It's an amazing film just as an artwork.
Well, thank you for that, saying that. But I think that one of the affinities I have to hip-hop culture is this idea of taking very little and turning it into something else. You know, that this kind of like brilliant creative formula of taking what you have around you and making it into something bigger. It's something that I've done in my personal art. I'm a collagist. I like taking disparate elements and juxtaposing them in a way to create new energy. And I saw that in their culture. This film is more about hip hop culture, not hip hop music, and because it includes dance and graffiti and you know, many other aspects of the culture. It's not simply about hip-hop music. And no, I wasn't a fan of hip-hop music, but I respect it. You know, I have a deep, deep respect for it.
There's also, I mean, when you talk about taking something small and making something bigger out of it, I mean, one of the things that is cool about the film and I guess hip-hop culture is taking things that are kind of ugly, like, you know, the steps down to the subway and stuff with dirt all over it and kind of ugly cityscapes, and changing them so that they have a kind of power and almost a beauty in themselves.
Yeah, well, I think that's the transformative power of art, and that's what these people are involved with. And, you know, I mean, they have harsh lives. They live in harsh surroundings, and which were made even harsher with the events of 9/11, and yet they found a way to express beauty and poetry and hope by transforming those, for lack of a better word, negative things and turning them into something positive.
There's also some emphasis on dance in the in the film, and the incredible importance of dance in hip-hop culture, in underground culture, in Black and Latino culture, and it's something that in a way I see as such a big division between that world and the kind of white middle class world that often does not have dance as being a part of it.
Well, yeah, you're right. I mean, and they make it very clear that this is a kind of an evolution of a tradition based in African culture.
Right.
You know, so they, you know, they come from a long line of dance and storytelling. And even one artist relates it back to Egyptian hieroglyphics, you know, graffiti. So it's actually part of the evolution of an ancient culture, you know, and it's the Americanization of that, you know, and it's a culture, and the aspects of this culture have spread worldwide at this point. You
yeah.
know, it's one of the biggest imports of. American cultural exports at this point in time, you know?
And not only economic exports in terms of music, but just in terms of the influence of that
music.
Yeah. It's everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, in fashion and in art and in music and in dance. I mean, aspects of hip-hop culture are popular in many, 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 many places internationally.
If it could have been patented, all those communities would be extremely wealthy.
Yes, well, that's true. But yet, I think what's so beautiful and sacred about the culture is that it's so organic and that it's so democratic. You know, unfortunately, some people did take control of commercializing aspects of it, and that's where the degradation and the sort of like the bad side effects took place. But in its purity, It's very spiritual.
What do you mean by that?
Well, there's been a tradition of the white man capitalizing on Black culture, Black music, and making all the money. And I think many of these artists make that point. And that was one of the reasons why many of these people voiced that that hip-hop music at some point, rap music is maybe a better way to describe it, became so negative in its expression because it sold records. I mean, that kind of hostility and negativity, you know, became very, very commercial. And yet this music did not have a beginnings of that. I mean, this culture was about celebrating life, a very urban life in the South Bronx, and it brought these people together in a way to celebrate through art, through dance, through music, and kept in a, if it had maintained that kind of purity and hadn't fallen into the hands of people who commercialized it and sort of packaged what sold commercially, I think it would have maintained a spiritual purity that is tough to maintain, you know?
What does your film look like? We're talking to Daryl Wilkes about his film Hip Hop Hope. What does it look like to you now, 10 years later?
Well, I'm very proud of it. I mean, and I think it's become an historical artifact. I mean, you know, there's elements, there's some elements visually of my shooting the actual towers as they were burning before they fell, and then
that was your own footage.
That's my own footage, and you know, and then I shot a lot of it in downtown Lower Manhattan, and so you know, including shots in and around the smoldering wreckage of Ground Zero. You know, New York changes so quickly, so dramatically. I mean, in those images, the images of the streets, the images of the subway, whatever, they're fleeting. You know, they existed 10 years ago, and life moves on, and it's changed, and it's different. So visually, I think it's it captures a moment in time, and it's an historical, you know, artifact.
So you were part of this weekend happening, sponsored by the Santa Fe Art Institute. Tell us a little bit about this weekend and your participation in it. You'll be doing Q&A at the screenings.
Yeah, it's... I don't want to really pretend to know how it's going to all unfold. I just know that there's going to be a discussion about the power of hip-hop to disseminate information and opinion and whatever, and Hip Hop Hope just happens to be an example of that, you know? I mean... People that know more about hip-hop culture than I do are going to be there and be involved. I don't pretend to know about, you know, to be an expert on hip-hop. I'm a documentary filmmaker. I was interested in the milieu, and I documented what people, what I saw and what people said. Other than that, you know, I'm just an observer.
Daryl Wilkes is writer, producer, and director of the film Hip Hop Hope, which will be screening this weekend, Saturday and Sunday. It's part of the Santa Fe Art Institute's 9/11 weekend. For more information, you can go to sfai.org, Santa Fe Art Institute, or you can call 505-424-5050. Daryl Wilkes, thanks for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm honored.
We're going to take a break. We'll be back in just a moment. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome to the program Gregory Chalette. He is an artist, activist, and author. His latest book is Dark Matter, Art and Politics in the Age of Enterprise Culture. And his work will be shown this weekend at the Santa Fe Art Institute. It's part of the 9/11 10 Years After series of events. And he will also be speaking on Tuesday, September 13th at 6 o'clock at Tipton Hall. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Barry.
So your work examines the relationships between art and society. And one thing that you point out is the broken promise of capitalism, and which probably a lot of people don't even really remember or know about, but that promise of freedom. You know, we were supposed to be free and have more leisure time as machines did the heavy labor of society and so on. What happened?
Well, I think you put it quite accurately, that there's almost a kind of implicit agreement that, you know, we will buy into this, to a system using money to exchange for goods, et cetera, et cetera. And the end goal will be increasing prosperity and less labor in sort of the worst sense of the word, you know, heavy working, et cetera. I think we've seen pretty clearly that that has all come undone for most people, particularly in the last few years, and it seems to be going into a descending spiral where they're talking now about a jobless future, where even if you have maybe a master's degree of some kind, you'll be lucky if you can get a kind of part-time job someplace, maybe even washing dishes. That may be extreme, but maybe it isn't extreme at the moment. So what happened was, I suppose, in a classical sense, there are internal contradictions that just don't let those two things work together. The ideal of freedom and freedom from scarcity, et cetera, and the ability for some people to concentrate large amounts of wealth and use those as they see fit. They just don't go together, those two different objectives.
So how does the capitalist way of working, which you have studied in a lot of depth, affect the lives and thoughts and minds of ordinary people, particularly the vast majority of us who are not exactly the winners in this game?
I think most people feel there isn't an alternative. That's perhaps the biggest problem. And it would be, you know, I would don't think anybody would want to go back and sort of hold up the old Soviet system or any of those so-called socialist countries as a model. It seems that idea of socialism has really failed. On the other hand, after the collapse of the Cold War, we don't really feel like there's an exit. We have just one system that we confront. And I think on a day-to-day basis, that is something that plays itself out so that people feel they have to choose between, let's say, presidential candidates who really don't offer any alternative per se, slightly different politics in some cases, and certainly no difference in the economic outlook. And in the end, it really is a question of the political economy. So as Slavoj Žižek sort of quipped once, you know, it's the political economy, stupid. And I think this is the question people need to kind of address, is that these things are linked. The economics and the politics are not separate spheres. They are actually intimately linked. I try to do with the book is really address that question or focus on that question in relationship to the workings of artists, the way artists work and how they work, and especially over the last 30 years.
Give us some examples of that. Kind of across the board. I mean, the way that artists are working that is really oriented toward a capitalist market economy and the ways that they are resisting that.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that artists, and it's not just artists, of course, lots of people are trying to find their own way to create a distance between themselves and the most brutal form of the market economy, which is playing itself out now. In such a vivid way, as we all know. But artists are particularly good at thinking in these kind of sideways or lateral moves where they make leaps that a lot of times people who have a more kind of linear way of working don't really try to go. They don't try to go there, and artists do go there, sometimes foolishly even, but they take those kind of strange chances to sometimes provide very interesting alternatives. And a lot of the most interesting work I see going on is actually where artists are linking up with people who are doing other kinds of community activism. So it's not just artists and it's not just the activists, but they're actually working together. An example would be the farm to table movement, which is part of, really grows out of, in some ways, the slow food movement from Europe. And it focuses on local produce, growing things ideally without pesticides, having the food be produced, consumed, and very much in a kind of local sphere, so you don't have the big box stores, the big grocery chains getting involved. And even though it may not be a solution for everybody, it certainly has become an interesting solution in many locations, such as Detroit and Chicago, Philadelphia, and in parts of New York. And there are artists, for example, Claire Pentecost and Brian Holmes. The latter is more of a theorist than an artist, but they work together, and they've been doing interesting work with this farm-to-table movement. Also in Baltimore, the Baltimore Development Cooperative has been doing work where they've created organic gardens and really focused on local foods. That's just one possible direction. There's other directions having to do with urban activism, etc.
What is the role of the artist in the farm-to-table and slow food movements?
In the cases that I gave, examples I gave, it's artists who are working with the food movement, and in many cases, their role is sometimes to simply do exactly what the activists are doing, which is to garden and produce the food and talk about the food. But they also engage as people who know how to use the visual realm or the communicative realm, maybe to produce explanatory materials that go with these gardens and with these ideas, with this idea of this kind of local circuit. And in some ways, their medium is also the ability to organize itself. It's almost as if they've taken on kind of the world of the social as a sculptural material that they are trying to channel in certain ways or assist in certain ways as to do exactly what we started talking about, which was to create alternatives, maybe modest ones, maybe very local ones, but alternatives to the sort of alienation of the global market.
Did you just say they use the social aspect as a sculptural medium? What do you mean, if I understood you correctly, what do you mean by that?
That they use, in a sense, you might say the social realm, let's say, or the idea of people working in a communal manner as almost a kind of artistic medium. So there are ways that they build organizational structure or try to invent alternative organizational structures, which is almost a kind of artistic practice at a certain level of abstraction, really.
When I think of the gifts that are given to artists, the talents that they have, I mean, I think of representation. So whether it's drawing or painting or sculpture or poetry or fiction or filmmaking or any of this stuff, you're looking at a whole big, vast world, selecting from it and representing it in some way. And the choices of what to represent and how to represent it are central. And I guess what I'm wondering is how this set of choices involved in representation is part of the movements that you've studied.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting question because I'm actually trying to suggest that maybe it isn't about representation, that a lot of the artists that we're talking about have sought to actually move in the direction of actually, you might say, manifestation, of actually sort of working in the real world almost, as I said, as a kind of material medium, that I wouldn't say that there's no element of representation involved. I think that one could make that argument, but maybe philosophically you can make the argument. But in a way, they're trying to actually constitute something that's material and real. And the question of representing something is maybe not what they're actually sort of driving for.
One thing that I find so striking and scary and kind of awful is the total marketing of every aspect of life. There seems to be less and less non-commercial space all the time. And I wonder, so I mean, there was a moment where they started putting ads on the turnstiles in subways, and they started putting ads inside of taxi cabs, and there's advertising everywhere you go, and, you know, even prisons are privatized, water is privatized, somebody copyrighted genetics. I mean, there are genes that are copyrighted, that are owned. Okay, is there, in your view, is there a natural breaking point? I mean, does it all fall apart at some point?
Well, I think what you described, of course, is extremely frightening. And I don't think that the realm of the arts has escaped it by any means. Maybe just to kind of keep question tight for a moment. My biggest concern is that some of these practices that we were just discussing, where artists are working with activists, etc., that some of these practices will themselves then end up becoming a kind of commercial brand. And I think it's very difficult to avoid, let's call it branding in a general sense, as you said, every object suddenly becoming part of a sales pitch in a sense. And so many things that we would have considered normally, let's say, part of the public world have become in a sense, privatized or owned, for example, as you say, the patents on certain genetic, codes even. So there's a kind of mining of everything that's not nailed down, and maybe even the things that are nailed down, by the market so that it owns all of that. Is there a tipping point? So it's a good question. I think one would like to think that there is some kind of elasticity that eventually snaps and pulls things back. This is a kind of, you might say in your mind, a kind of physics metaphor. We think that if we drop a ball, it falls. We assume if we slip, then we fall down. You know, gravity is going to knock us down. We apply these things thinking there are sort of natural limits. It's not clear that there really are natural limits to this process. And it may really require organizing clearly in opposition to it and not trying to fall back on the idea that somehow it's going to sort itself out, because I don't think it will. I think, you know, people are going to have to wake up and do something. I'll just give you one quick example. Critical Art Ensemble is a group, and they've done a lot of work around the question of privatizing the biosphere, you know, for example, genetically modified foods. They actually tried to create a kind of take-home test so you could bring your vegetables home from the market and see if they'd been genetically altered or if they were, you know, pre-genetically altered types of foods. They're really interesting, very, very engaged artists, and they try to also produce this work in such a way that it's a gift. This kind of goes back to the previous question. There is at work something of a gift economy that opposes itself to the idea of the branded market. And many of the artists and activists who I was referring to try to kind of operate in the realm of the gift, giving things without expecting anything in return. And that Critical Art Ensemble, I would recommend to listeners, maybe Google them, take a look at what they've done. One of the narratives attached to this is that one of the founders was actually investigated by the FBI. In fact, he was being prosecuted by the Justice Department for about 4 years under the George Bush Jr. administration. And finally, that case was solved, but you can look this up. And in some ways, this was probably a reaction to the group's criticism of the Iraq War, the criticism of the way the government was moving after 9/11, and also a criticism of the privatization of things like genetics, biology, plants, etc., the Monsanto Corporation being one of their targets.
We're talking to Greg Chalette, artist, activist, and author, and his latest book is called Dark Matter, Art and Politics in the Age of Enterprise Culture. I think one of the things that's so difficult about the critique of capitalism is that a good portion of consumer culture actually does make our lives, people who have access to it, which is most of us here in the United States, more comfortable. And so if you took away, you know, laptops, central heating, cheap Advil, things like that, people would go absolutely bananas. And so there's a kind of hesitation to throw the whole thing out. Nobody wants to do that. But to kind of keep the good parts and get rid of the bad parts, that gets very complicated very quickly.
Let's not forget things like Ambien.
Yeah, well, I don't know about that one, but Advil is my good friend.
Ambien helps you sleep at night. I mean, I think your point's well taken, and I don't envision a society, either from a kind of, let's say, environmental critical position in which, you know, there's no conveniences left and we're all like sitting around caves, which is absurd, or from a kind of anti-capitalist position where there is no such thing as any kind of exchange or production or useful devices or technological innovation. I have a feeling sometimes these are like kind of panic button responses to the idea that we need to rethink the system of the economic system we live in, it's as if, well, if we have to do that, then we have to change everything and there won't be any of the good things left. I think that's, you know, really a kind of extreme way to look at it, and not one that I think anyone would endorse.
Right, but then what do you change, what do you keep the same, and who makes those decisions?
Well, I guess one of the questions would be is it necessary for example, the heads of corporations, the heads of the financial sector, and I'm talking about the heads of the corporations themselves in many cases, but also the chair people that are on these organizations, et cetera, is it necessary for them to be making salaries that are astronomically greater than the people that work for them? What is it about the concentration of wealth, particularly at this moment, that needs to be directly addressed, and why is it seem to be moving in the other direction, where some of the most prominent candidates for the president are literally talking about even concentrating more wealth in a smaller sector of the economy? What about education? What are people going to do when they have lots of education that they've paid for, that they're in debt for, and what they've done is essentially have skills, or they produce skills that they can't even realize on the marketplace? Nobody's interested in them doing what they were doing. They end up doing, if they're lucky, things that maybe are in the service sector. These are the kind of questions that one has to sort of ask and begin with to address your question, which is, all right, let's talk about how wealth is distributed and who gets the benefits. I think some of the other issues would fall into place if we began to look at things in those terms.
That is very much of the kind of question that many, many political activists are asking. And so getting back to the role of the arts, what is the role of the arts, of the artist, of artist collectives in putting those questions out to ordinary people and getting those discussions going?
I think the role of the arts is going to be what, you know, artists can make of it, what they will make of it, and maybe what they're pushed to make of it. It's pretty clear that a lot of artists don't really reflect on these questions. They don't look at the questions in terms of their own practice or the world of the arts, let's call it, the market for the arts, which they're inevitably part of. This is one of the reasons that I wrote the book, was in a way to shine a light on the practice of artists and to ask some of these fundamental questions about, let's say, economic justice, actually at the level of artistic production. And that's maybe in some ways not addressing the question you asked, which is, what can artists do for, like, everybody else? But I do think that artists themselves need to first take a look at their own situation and examine carefully, what is the political economy of the art world? How might that change? And by doing that, you also take a step towards raising those issues in a broader sense. In terms of your question, there's clearly a number of artists, and I've already mentioned some of these groups, Critical Art Ensemble, the Yes Men, Baltimore Development Cooperative, Center for Tactical Media. There are a number of artists who are trying to sort of put forth in a more public way these very questions through their art, sometimes doing it with a great deal of humor, like the Yes Men, but they're trying to get it beyond just the realm of the arts. And I really applaud that kind of work, although I think that there's room for all kinds of artistic activity. I do applaud those kinds of interventionist, let's say, practices. And that's one model that people could begin to sort of focus on.
Well, when you look at the difference between the model of the Yes Men and the model of somebody making art and trying to sell their art in galleries, often to the wealthiest class of people who are the heads of these corporations or who are in a much higher income bracket. But, I mean, the Yes Men, those are academics who have tenured jobs at universities, so it's just apples and oranges.
Well, actually, it's not the case. only one of the yes men actually has an academic job upstate New York.
Well, one of the two.
Yeah, and the other one is actually, I think, actually on the job market, by the way, at the moment. And they didn't begin the work they were doing as yes men with academic jobs or security, I can tell you that. But they're also broke, you know, and they've put enormous amounts of their own money into the projects they did and, of course, haven't really realized much in the way of personal profit from it.
Yeah, exactly. What I'm saying is they need an outside income source. So, you know, either they have an academic job or they have a job in commerce or they get funding from somebody else. But it's not a way of making, the models that you're suggesting are not a way of making a living.
No, I don't think it's a question of necessarily being able to make a living in this economy. I mean, it's not like I can say to one of my students, I teach in a city school, which is a public school here in New York, it's not like I can say to one of these young people who are often the first generation to go to college, hey, you should be just like the yes men and spend all your time doing interventionist art, because I know very well that that's a very, very difficult road to take for anybody. So although I present that kind of work, certainly don't hold it up as the model for everyone. That doesn't mean one can't begin to sort of think about the way this kind of practice influences what you do, and it should. As far as sort of being sustainable, I think that's kind of the question you're getting at. It's a very difficult one right now with the economy crashed everywhere, but there's two things to keep in mind. One is that artists have always been very, very good at finding these kind of odd ways of surviving. Just as I mentioned earlier, that they kind of think in sideways terms, they're very good at creating little niches for themselves to sort of get by. And, you know, that's a plus. I think if artists began to really work together, they might look at the value that's been accumulated and accumulates in the art world on a regular basis and start to ask the same questions about, well, why is it that a few artists or a very small group actually have so much of a share of the overall value that the art world generates, because, in a sense, everyone participates in creating that value. And there are maybe ways to address that problem, particularly using some of the new technologies. So think, for example, of a peer-to-peer kind of art world, or P2P art world, in which the galleries and you know, the large collectors maybe are bypassed for a different level of exchange. It's not a radically political suggestion. It's just perhaps a way for artists to sort of survive in this situation.
What do you mean by that? Like when you say the galleries and collectors are bypassed, what is the alternative model?
Okay, so let's say you set up a series of internet sites where people could access your work, and people who wanted to buy your work just went ahead and did it. I can give you an example, which would be Just Seeds, which is a site that you can actually, it's Just Seeds, JustSeeds.org, and it's a website set up by a number of artists who sell their work very inexpensively, and yet you're actually able to make enough to kind of continue with the website. So, hang on one second. Hi, Howie.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an example of one way to, you know, kind of self-organize in relationship to, you know, the current economic situation.
Gregory Chalette is an artist, activist, and author. His latest book is Dark Matter, Art and Politics in the Age of Enterprise Culture. And once again, his work will be shown this weekend at the Santa Fe Art Institute. It's part of the 9/11 10 Years After events. And he will be speaking on Tuesday, September 13th at 6 o'clock at Tipton Hall on the campus of the Santa Fe University of Art and Design. For more information, 505-424-5050. Or you can call, you can go to the website, SFAI.org. Greg, thanks so much for being with us at the Radio Cafe.
Absolutely, Mary. You're welcome.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.